probably make much more sense to do one of these shrinky kind of things. You know, circle and talk, and we're I'll let you all direct the discussion. I'll either start right away that way, or I could give a couple of opening remarks, whichever way you want to go.
I just want to start by directing the learning and discussion tonight for a Refuah Shleima for Meredith Farrell. Mrs. Ross, Bella Ross, just told me that two of her grandchildren and possibly a third were just called up, and obviously a nerve-wracking experience and not news that that any grandmother wants to hear. So in addition for the learning and discussion tonight should be Refuah Shleima for Rachel Miriam Bat Shifra Yenta, and should be a zchut for a very successful campaign and speedy and safe return for all of the soldiers who are fighting in protection for Israel and for all of us.
Amen.
Amen. One last thing also. Scott Farrell sent an email to Rabbi Leibowitz and to myself right before this evening, and he asked that one of us read it. I'm going to ask Rabbi Leibowitz to read it.
Okay, I'm just going to, Rabbi Septimus, just want to read the email that Scott sent. I'll just read exactly his words. On behalf of the entire Farrell family, I wanted to take this opportunity to thank the entire community for its support, well wishes, tefillot, and more. However, the words thank you seem inadequate for the task, more suitable to expressing appreciation for being complimented on one's tie, or politely recognizing that the waiter has brought you your main course. What we as a family experienced and the warmth and outpouring of love and concern that we received from the neighborhood far exceeds anything that mere words could properly express our appreciation. From Tehillim gatherings, Shiurim, tonight's program, sponsoring Father Son Learning, cooking for us, watching my kids, baking challahs, showing up at my front door with gas for the car, the list goes on. And still people ask what they can do for me, even though every family in the neighborhood has been dealing with their own difficulties as a result of Hurricane Sandy. To that end, I figured I would strike while the iron is hot and come up with the following non-exclusive list. Number one, please convince Esti that it's acceptable for me to sleep on Marvel superhero sheets, not just at the Bikur Cholim apartment by L.A.J., but at home too. Number two, ask me when you can tell the story at Father Son or Father Daughter Learning. Number three, hug your mom, dad, sister, brother, or favorite cousin. Number four, you know that guy who you're mad at, and rightfully so? Forgive him, even if he doesn't deserve it. Number five, invite a family that you've never had over for a Shabbat meal, even if they daven across the street or down the block from you. Number six, go to the Young Israel of North Woodmere game night on November 25th to raise money for Gift of Life. Jordan, please let me know if this qualifies as being called a neighborhood hero in your next email.
Yeah.
Number seven, ask your friendly neighborhood rabbi how you can get more involved in your shulam community. The list goes on, but that's really to deflect attention away from my desire to have my very own Wolverine pillowcase and Fantastic Four bedspread. On a more serious note, although Mary asked that I not share sensitive medical information, please rest assured that every day she gets stronger and stronger. You should know that once we shared that it was Meredith, rather than an anonymous name on a Tehillim list, the outpouring of davening, learning, Tehillim, etc. was amazing, and not coincidentally marked the point where Mer turned the corner and began to improve. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts and look forward to, God willing, sharing Simchot with everyone in the near future.
So nice about that is I was just thinking that among the most protective elements in dealing with something like the aftermath of a hurricane or ongoing concern about what's happening in Israel is exactly that. In other words, you know, when you have control over something, you do whatever you can in terms of what you have control over. When you don't have control over something, you always have control over acts of chesed and connection to community and some of the other things that we'll talk about tonight in terms of what promotes resilience and protection from post-traumatic response. but if it would be okay, let's hear what's on your mind. You know, let's hear sort of what kind of issues you guys are sort of like came here to hear about, and I'll certainly do my best. And I'm also going to welcome. We have a very well-known expert in terms of primary prevention of post-traumatic stress disorder, and in terms of Dr. Frogel, who's done a lot of work in this area, both here and in Israel. So we have a team here to work on this. So let's hear. Who's going to be the brave Nachshon here? Please.
One thing I think that came up a lot for our community, which I always felt was kind of in the middle of the spectrum of destruction, storm related. And I never really knew if we were, the people that should help or the people that need help going forward. And I think a lot of people struggle with that as time was going on. Like, are we supposed to look at Pearl Harbor and get out there because they're desperate? Or do we say, you know what, there's still water in my basement right now. And until the water's gone, or until, my adjuster comes by, I'm potter, from helping anybody else. This is because I'm a victim too. So I think a lot of people struggle with that. Like, are we those who, this community specifically, are we those who need to help, or are we those who are looking for help?
Right. It's interesting because I think I've been hearing, I've had some meetings like this in different parts of the five towns and with different groups, rabbis, therapists, etc. And that's one of the most common issues coming up here, which is an interesting issue. Is sort of like the comparisons, first of all, that people are making and saying, do I have a right to be upset, even if I lost an awful lot in a flooded basement, or my cars blew up, or whatever it might be, but look at how other people in places like El Harbor or parts of Far Rockaway or Oceanside or Seagate or whatever are suffering so much more. And I don't have an easy answer for it other than just to say a few simple things. One is, regardless of where on the metric of suffering any individual is, it's very important to give yourself permission to respond emotionally and to experience the full range of emotions and to validate your feelings. So that's extremely important. I think that it's not a contest of some kind. It's not like, and there's something uniquely Jewish, I think, about our tendency sometimes to be tough on ourselves in terms of that. It's fine to both feel intense feelings in response to what's happening, to give yourselves permission to do it, and to give yourself permission to also to accept help. It's also important to, when you can and when you have the energy, to respond to the extent that in the spirit of Aniyecha Ercha Kodmet, okay? To also, once you feel that you're in a position to do it, to go out and help others. That's often very therapeutic and is one of the most helpful things you can do for yourself as well as for others. But it's a balancing act. After Katrina, I was working with some people some kids in the Jewish community who lost everything. And many of the adolescents were having a very, very hard time, not only with having to ask for basic needs. These were kids from upper middle class homes who suddenly had nothing. They were living in other people's homes. They were without any resources at all. They had to ask for something as simple as basic school supplies. And they were really struggling with it. And one of the things that we arranged for them was each one of these adolescents was assigned to another kid who lost everything in Katrina, but like, let's say, a preschooler. So they would meet with, let's say, a five-year-old kid or a six-year-old kid, find out what they lost, what they were missing most. Might have been a favorite doll, it might have been a favorite toy, it might have been a favorite blanket. And their job was to take care of, they were given gift cards and they were given money to go out and buy with those kids what they needed. And that in turn made it easier for them to accept. So So it's this cyclical kind of process where you have to know yourself, know what your emotional resources are, put your oxygen mask on first, as we've been hearing over and over again, in terms of caring for yourself. And then when you feel ready to go out to the Bell Harbors, you know, out there and go out to places that are most affected, to be able to do that as well. Does that make sense to people? Sort of that kind of balance? Or?
If I could just give an example from Sderot. So for years, the people and the kids in Sderot felt like abandoned. And they were leaving the city in droves. And, you know, there's still a huge number of people with post-traumatic or ongoing stress disorder. There's no post in Sderot. It's continuous. It's different than almost anywhere. And it's very serious. But I work with a guy named Alon Davidi, who's a officer in the IDF, but he also does community stuff. And what he started doing years ago is getting the teenagers and the kids who, you know, the older you get, you have your own psych, et cetera. The little kids tend to reflect what's going on with the parents, but these kids were devastated. They were laying around doing nothing, basically, and he got them to form groups, like a group of clowns, okay? And they'd go to the little kids, and they'd go to houses, and they'd go to make sufganiyot on, for Hanukkah time, and give it to the army, okay? So they got tasks to do. And these kids came out of their shells, and they got better. It was extremely therapeutic for them to be part of the response while they're getting shelled, okay? And it turns out that that's a very, very important thing to do. Some people can do it, some people can't. Some people are like malachim. I don't know how they do it. Like there are guys, Magen Dover, psychologists in Sderot, who like, I spoke about this morning, they just are able to just put everything aside and like, I'm helping everybody, okay? Those people are somewhat unique heroes, okay? But for the regular guys like us, okay, when you have to take care of your own stuff. I mean, from my own experience, I'm a disaster expert in New York City. I'm in charge of pediatric disaster preparedness. The first couple of days, I had to deal with my own family. I had to deal with total destruction. You know, I didn't have a place to live. You know, I had to get gas. I'm allowed to get gas in this special, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But just coming out of my own shell was very hard. Now I'm like fully engaged. I've talked to the FEMA. I talked to the state. I've driven everyone crazy. But it took me time. Okay, it just because you're overwhelmed, and you may not realize it, how overwhelmed you are. But I do, and that's been my personal experience. So I think for everyone going through this, and you also don't realize, sometimes you're acting in certain ways, like you don't know really why. It's just like, why am I nudgy? Why am I like, you know, whatever? It's normal, it's okay. And it's okay to not have helped other people, because you gotta, you know, have some living, okay? You gotta be able to care for some of your own things before you can help others. You know, it's like, yes, put the oxygen mask on first for you and then help the other person on the plane, which is exactly the point, okay? But, you know, you have to, that's human nature, and we're going through, and everyone's in their own way is going through the same thing, some to a more extent more than others. We don't understand resiliency. Resiliency means something bad happens and you're good. You're resilient, okay? Other people are not so resilient. There's a whole bunch of experiments going on, you know, to figure that out, but... You have to give yourself some breathing space, and you have to recognize that you're having some service here, and it's good to understand that that's what everyone's going through. And then you get back in the saddle, so to speak, which is very therapeutic, to get back to start doing things. You know,
one of the most important components of this is the recognition that there's tremendous variability in people's capacity for resilience and bouncing back, and also in the way people cope. They have a tremendous variability in whether or not somebody's going to respond by talking, by distracting, by throwing themselves into helping others. And you may be married to somebody or have close family members who have exactly the opposite coping style that you have. And one of the important things in terms of resilience building is to recognize that one size doesn't fit all, and to not be judgmental about somebody who's close to you who has another kind of way of coping, and to figure out together the best way of building up a toolbox of coping mechanism that's going to work for you and work for your spouse and work for your children, because it's going to vary tremendously even within the same family, let alone within the same neighborhood. So that's another component of all of this. I'm going to take a, well, let's,
So my biggest frustration is just the human dimension was just the incompetence of life and officials and just not being prepared. The basics like gas stations not having $1,000, $2,000 generators. Then we fight big wars in this country and we can't even basically put a concerted effort here. I think that's the over frustration here and probably all throughout Long Island and what have you. The question is, yes, it's over, a few weeks we're gone, until the next, God forbid, next hurricane there. Where are the public officials? Where was the outcry? We did an Oceanside demonstration, took people 2 weeks to get together and all that. So I think there has to be an accounting of the public officials. We still have resignations at the LIPA level and all that. I think where are public officials here? We have to realize that this is an important political block, and I think that's part of the action talk which should come out of this.
See, that's a perfect example. Notice that's I was speaking earlier to different people. Everybody has a different focus and a different way of viewing, and your focus is wonderful, which is how do you get the meaning out of this in terms of, okay, how do you go from your own narrow needs thinking about real societal change and being an advocate for societal change. I'll just say one thing, and this is with something that's obvious, but I'll just talk about it for a minute or two. Over the long haul, when you look at the various research studies and similar kinds of situations, you find that there's two parallel responses that go on. One is a very justified anger. And at times an intense anger at what's happened, why has it happened to me, asking why, but also rightful anger at incompetence, at governmental kinds of incompetence. We're just hearing about total mismanagement at different levels of government, be it by FEMA or by LIPO or by local city or state or national government. Over the long haul, though, what study after study shows is that at a certain point, it's very adaptive to have an angry response and to have an activist response, but at a certain point, a huge ingredient in healing is focusing on the positive. Focusing on gratitude for what you have, coming up with action plans and fighting for change and doing everything in your power to have that kind of response, but ultimately just to take a step back so that we know, for example, after 9/11, people who were most impacted, people who lived within a 3-mile radius of the World Trade Center, or people who had immediate loss in their family, those who over the long run were able to eventually get to a place of being able to focus with gratitude on what they had as opposed to what they lost, and were able to, after they did all the advocacy they could to go to a place of focus on the positive, they had a trajectory of healing that was much faster than those who didn't. I'm not talking about now. Now I think it would almost be inappropriate not to share those feelings. And it's always appropriate to try to get change going. But just also, to the extent that gratitude, like what you just read, Rabbi Leibowitz, in terms of gratitude for chesed, in terms of moving on in that way, it makes all the difference. I was in Frankfurt week before last. I spent time in Frankfurt at a conference for Holocaust survivors who stayed in Europe. And amazing experience, and I'd been there once before, and it was one of the lessons there is, I'll just share with you something that I was talking to them about in terms of this, because the survivors were talking about both. They were talking about the parallel path of their rage and their anger, which who could question that, but also what they ultimately found to get them to the next step. So there's, I'll share with you, it's a brief story of two perceptions of a Friday night bracha. This is one of the things that was discussed, you know, about a week and a half ago. One was this survivor who is extremely warm guy, very optimistic guy. Everybody wants to be around him. And in talking to him, it's clear to me that he somehow was remarkable in terms of his resilience, even though he'd been through unbelievable suffering in Auschwitz. So I asked him the obvious question, which is, to the extent that our rabbis tell us, ma'at min ha'or docha harbe min choshech, little sparks of light push away a great deal of darkness. I said, what was your source of light? And he told me that when he was going through the worst parts of his time in the camps, and he, in a very evocative way, described these horrific kinds of scenes that he was subjected to. So he talked about being woken up at 4 a.m. and having dogs set on him and having to stand out at attention for hours at a time in the freezing cold. He said what got him through was picturing his father giving him the Friday night bracha before he was sent into the camps. He said he'd feel the warmth of his father's hands on his head and the warmth of his father's breath sort of breathing down on him and feeling totally enveloped in his father's embrace. And he said that's what got me through. It was the image and the memory of that bracha. I shared this with some people, and another survivor comes over to me, and he says, you know something? He says, I hear what you're saying. He says, but you know something? When I see my son give my grandchildren a bracha, I have an opposite response. I just can't let go of how Hitler robbed me of that experience. Both totally understandable reactions, both totally, totally easy to see where it's coming from. But the question always becomes one of, is there at some point a way to give a little bit more psychological space in your head? Maybe not yet, maybe it's too soon. And we're talking about a very different kind of trauma, obviously, you know, but at some point, we know that you get quicker to a point of resolution and resilience when you could figure out a way to come up with your source of light and source of inspiration on a positive track as well as on the anger track. Both valid, both important, and it's a balancing act. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Last week, I guess when we were in the second week of not having power, there was a very clear sense of anxiety, anger, a lot of unsettled people, and that has an impact, apparently, clearly any anxiety has an impact on Shalom Bayis. And my wife said to me, one of the things she said, I think the day before we got power back, was I don't know anybody who's still talking to their husbands right now. So, you know, it was,
yeah.
She said it as half jokingly, hopefully entirely jokingly, but half jokingly. And I was just thinking in the aftermath, is that just something that was, there are probably a lot of people that had a lot of stress on their marriage because there was a lot of stress on their lives. Is it, should we be running some sort of program or just assume people will figure it out and get it back together?
Let me bounce off that a little bit. I'll talk to you about the Iowa studies, and then I'll give it over to Dr. Fergal on this. In the Iowa studies, they looked in 1980s. There were a bunch of people in the Midwest, particularly in Iowa, who were wealthy people living on large farms, doing very well. And then it crashed. That whole system crashed. And there was a group of very competent psychologists who studied those people and their kids for the next 30 years. To see when you lost everything. These are people who lost the farm, literally lost the farm, had to move into little one-room apartments or studios for years on end. Kids lost all their toys. The couple suddenly went into this extremely stressful situation, and they looked at what predicted those families who were resilient and PTSD-free, and those families who succumbed and really fell apart, turned out the number one predictor of resilience was the ability of, in spite of the loss, of the couples to minimize the exposure of conflict to their children and to ultimately come out of it in a way that they work together. My father always says, couples don't have to think alike, they have to think together. That's not easy. You know, there's the Gemara in Bava Metzia about when there's financial concerns, when there's not enough tefuah in the house, couples grate at each other, and there's more fighting, and shalom bayis suffers. There's tremendous wisdom in that. Now, the most normal reaction is going to be during this acute phase is going to be for there to be an increase in fighting, partly exacerbated by the fact that men and women deal with trauma and stress in totally different ways. Women may respond by wanting to talk a lot, by wanting to, whatever it might be, and men may respond by becoming problem solving. There's a lot of opportunity for there to be, at the time you need to be working together most, to be a rift. So recommendation number one is to see this as a normal reaction to an abnormal event. You're going to hear from Dr. Frogel in a few minutes about how in Israel, in Sderot, when they do the resilience training, the psychological first aid, one of the most important messages is a message that says that almost anything is a normal reaction to an abnormal event, and there's certain guidelines in self-care that you figure out how to find your way as a couple. I'll tell you a quick vignette. Friday after 9/11, a couple comes to see me. He was a young newlywed. They hadn't been married that long before. And he finds himself in the concourse of the World Trade Center. And a bunch of firemen are telling about 400 people down there, whatever you do, don't leave. If you leave, the safest place is to stay here in the concourse. There are steps that clearly gave them a free exit. But the firemen were blocking the exit, saying, if you run up there, you're going to get yourself killed. There's falling debris. The safest place is to stay here. Of course, everybody who stayed was killed, you know. He was raised by a Holocaust survivor, two Holocaust survivors, who told him never trust anybody in a uniform. And he pushes the firemen away, runs up the stairs to safety. 40 people follow him. He tells me he likes to think the 40 people were all second or third generation of survivors who were raised not to trust anybody in a uniform. He walks home. It was like he lived like somewhere in Brooklyn. And he walks over the bridge. It takes him all day to walk home. His cell phone didn't work. His wife, they'd only been married not that long ago, was in a state of panic. And he spends, from that Tuesday to that Friday, nonstop needing to talk to her about the trauma he had been through and needing to watch TV nonstop. Problem was that her style was, he was a talker, right? Dagablavish Yashchena, he was the Yasichena Lachera, right? The Gemara says this three times in Shas, right? You have a warrior in your heart, there's Machlokes between Ravam and Ravasi. One says, don't think, distract yourself. The other mandamar says, talk it out. There's no decision in the Gemara, as I understand, saying one way is better than the other. She was a specialist in distraction, he was a specialist in talking. They were, by the time they came to me on that Friday, she wanted to leave him. She said, he is driving me crazy. And he wanted to leave her because he said, she doesn't understand what I've been through, okay? So all I did, and you're going to hear the power of this, the power of psychoeducation, the power of simple, I just explained to her, this is what trauma, people have gone through trauma, many of them need to talk it out. The more they talk things out, they need to compulsively talk about it. They need to talk. They need to go through the narrative in their heads over and over again, and it's their form of healing. And even though it may drive you crazy, it's the best way you could help them. And then I turned to her, to him, and I said, and she can't necessarily be the person you talk to all the time because she's not wired that way. And we came up with a list of five people he could call to talk to instead of her. I asked her to accept some of the narrative from him at times. I then asked them how much wedding money they had left. And they had plenty of wedding money left. I said, please, take $200, go to the local Sears, buy yourself some cheap TV with headphone jack in it, and watch as much TV as you want, but do it with the headphones on. It worked. It worked. I've been in touch with them on and off in the years afterwards. They just needed to get through that simple early stage of understanding that men and women are different to begin with. Under stress, your differences become even more exacerbated. Ultimately, over the long run, like the Iowa studies show, you have to figure out a way to learn to think together, even though you don't think alike. And that's the key. I think that there might be a need, and it might be helpful if, in fact, it continues. It's a normal reaction for couples to want to kill each other at a time like this. Don't forget, you're dealing with insurance companies and with flooding, and in some cases with really traumatic events of the trauma of being overcome by whatever you might have been overcome with. You suddenly might have to be spending weeks with family who you may not like so much, or you may like so much, whatever it might be. And all of that puts stress on a couple. The key is to figure out a way to just normalize them and say, this is normal. And it doesn't mean that we can't eventually figure out a way to think better. Over the long run, usually if couples just recognize this and understand that this is what happens and try to, in spite of it, to connect and work together, and especially not to fight in front of the kids, it makes all the difference in the world. You want to take something on this, or?
Yeah. I don't like using stay road as an example because, as I said, it doesn't go away. It's like it's continuous. And unfortunately, in stay road, the kids have terrible problems, and they're ongoing. They regress. They want to sleep with their parents all the time, which is understandable because when the bombs are going off, they're in the shelters together. There are families who haven't slept in their own beds for 7 years. Okay, their kids are in bed with them all the time. The incidence of marital discord, psychiatric illness, kids with problems is horrific. I won't give you the numbers because you're getting more freaked out. But again, the majority of the people have the ability to get beyond this. But there it's a bit different. But what you said is extremely important. Men and women are different. Every individual is different. Okay. And what I find is you have to give, if someone's acting out, if your wife is screaming her head off and you have to do this and going nuts, so to speak, I find giving them space to let them do their thing instead of saying, calm down, mm-hmm. cut this crap out, mm-hmm. we got to clean out the basement, mm-hmm. you're acting like a lunatic, it's going to go doubly bad, okay? It doesn't work, okay? They're doing their thing, so to speak, in the acute phase. And you got to say, back off. I understand. I hear how you're dealing with it. I'm going to go, do this. And just kind of, sometimes you got to step away because you keep going, you're flaming the fire. Okay? Very hard to do, but it's a very relevant technique. And you have to understand that people literally go mishogo. I mean, they're not rational. Okay? They may be very irrational, and that's normal, okay? If you can start to think that way, in that, even for the individual themselves, okay, the people who are at most risk are the ones who their breathing gets fast and their heart rate goes up and they really physiologically are experiencing it. You got to try to ground them in some thought process that gets them to kind of focus away from the disaster and how they're feeling and start thinking about, tell me, what sounds are you hearing now? Something that's a complete, flips a switch and turns that off is very useful. And you all can't be psychologists, et cetera, but there's very simple techniques. The most important thing is to recognize that this is normal behavior, not to take it personally, okay, but to try to focus on what you can do together. Like, even with my own wife, it was horrendous, okay, when we first went back to the house. I tried to ground her in the grandchildren, or something positive about it. And for the kids' sake, they're going to be calling us from Israel. We can't be crying on the phone. That kind of stuff tends to sometimes make a breakthrough, okay? And if you get to focus on helping somebody else or within your own crap that's going on, so to speak, get somehow that little spark that sets you away from it can be very helpful. But the most important ikkar is that it's normal. It's normal to freak out. It's normal to act out. Or it's normal to be totally quiet. Or it's normal to be happy. You know, and completely ridiculous, okay? But all these kind of reactions, every human being is different, okay? And the team approach is very important, but sometimes you got to give it a little time before you can do that, okay? You got to let each one react in their own way, but then try to develop, like, okay, listen, I know I'm upset, you're upset, but this 8 feet of water in my basement, and we got to deal with this, okay? I had a personal experience with as the flood was happening. I wasn't in Bell Harbor because I listened to the authorities usually, because I'm one of them sometimes. You know, it was like it was a defeated thing. It was like some of the people involved just said, "I give up. I can't take it anymore." You know, while this, everything was going on, and like they just sat down things, and eventually they started doing it also. Okay, so sometimes it's more important to not do than to do, especially with men and women together, because sometimes you can inflame it, so to speak. But you may be another one of the individuals may say, and they keep going in your face about it. It's hard for that person to not do that because they need it. Okay, so for that person, it's hard. It's tough. It's a tough thing to do. But you hope that the other person somehow has some modicum of understanding. Okay, but it none of this is easy. You also have to give people. You have to realize that what they said yesterday or what they did 2 hours ago, they completely change. Okay, and don't keep harping on you did this to me, I did that to you, because it's normal to act completely aberrantly and wrongly, and don't hold grudges, guys, because that's not going to get you anywhere. Okay.
How many years ago? Many centuries ago. Sefer Chassidim. He wrote three words that captures this: Achris Ketata Charata. After argument, there's regret. So you'll never regret the pullback response that you're hearing about from Dr. Froebel. You'll just never regret it, and that's usually the best advice of all. When you have couples with totally different styles of responding to trauma, which is normative, what I find over time is if you could figure out a way to respond with acceptance of their differential style, just accept it, over time you tend to meet together, over time. Yeah, please.
Well, so just for something that you said resonated, like how there does come maybe a point, maybe it's after the second blackout or, you know, when the water, we were in Long Beach, you know, afterwards, and somebody told me, you know, the water went by, the surge went by, nothing happened, and then some water came up in the basement, and they pumped it out, and then like a day later, Long Beach shut the sewers, and they're just basically just filled up with sewage. We cleaned this guy's house out, and I see the reaction is just give up, like just I'm done with this, like when you're out of power. And we're talking about different responses that are okay. I'm wondering, is that response ever okay? Is it ever okay, like, is it ever okay to just be paralyzed and surrender?
You know what? In the short term, of course it is. In the short term, that's the normal reactions of somebody faced with overwhelming threat is sometimes to play possum, and sometimes to just freeze.
Yeah.
That's normal. Mm-hmm. And the key, though, is over time, I had a relative, an elderly relative, who lived a couple of blocks from the ocean in Far Rockaway, okay? And I guess I just identified him. His initial reaction was one of just saying, I'm not getting out of here. Even though everybody
That's
knew
dangerous.
That was crazy.
Yeah.
And all he needed was a good night's sleep. That's all he needed. And he needed a little bit of space. And then he woke up after a good night's sleep, and he went from that paralysis to immediately going along with relocating and doing what he needed to do. But he needed the space, and everybody knew that there was a little bit of time to play with until the real evacuation took over. I think that's the key. The key is to know how to how to ride the waves sometimes. You know, like it says in the Gemara, Anelo Rosho, right? Kiva says that when he was swept up by waves in a shipwreck, he survived by knowing how to ride the waves. And that's not a bad metaphor for what we're talking about here in more ways than one. One or two points I want to make just to broaden this a little bit and to keep with some general guidelines. This is one that's not obvious, You probably heard it, but I'll tell it to you because I feel so strongly about it. We knew after 9/11 that it could be very damaging for certain kids to watch media coverage a lot. Turns out it's a, we knew from Oklahoma City and from a study we did that I was involved in years ago after the Armenian earthquake, the kids who watch TV news heavily after a natural disaster were much greater risk for long-term post-traumatic stress reactions, especially if you have a kid who's an anxious type. But kids in general don't have enough real-life information to be able to watch TV easily. Now, with what's happening in Israel, there's still footage going on of continued devastation in some of our communities. You put on top of that, you know, constant news about what's happening in Sderot and happening now in Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv. We have to realize that as glued to the TV set as we need to be, our children hear this more than you could think. After 9/11, it's interesting, I don't know if I even told this to you, Lonnie. After 9/11, my daughter Michal, who today is interestingly a third year doctoral student in clinical psychology specializing in trauma, we were doing some, we were developing a questionnaire partly having to do with media exposure, because we knew it was bad. And we were one of the centers doing some of the research on the psychological response to 9/11. So I used her as one of our guinea pigs. So I give Michal a questionnaire about, because we didn't allow our kids to watch TV that much. Is Karen here?
Yeah.
Remember to watch TV at home?
Thank God.
Anyway, and I look at the pilot that I gave Michal, and it turned out, without me knowing it, she was watching TV because she was so glued to this. So she was sneaking into our basement to watch TV news at times. I had no idea. And see what happens over the long run? She's now into PTSD big time. That's what she's doing her dissertation on. So I don't know if that's a good outcome or a bad outcome, but some kind of an outcome. But the reality is, it's very easy for our kids to overhear when we don't think they're overhearing, especially now.
Yeah,
especially
how do you unplug them? I know, like my son, I have an older son, he has a handicap, but he's zooming into the internet and stuff like that, and he is freaked out now about this whole power outage and losing. He's very insecure, but you know, there's the internet, there's TV, there's the radio. And, you know, I mean, even before, after the first blackout, I mean, the blackout really was the thing that really terrified him. And then he kept asking me, is it going to happen again? I go, no, it won't happen again for a long time. Of course, 2 days later, it happened again.
Oh,
you know, so now that's, you know, I got to, like, what I say to him. But, like, I don't know, how do you really do that? You know, and, like, how do I give him screw? Because he's still freaked out. He hears now, there's a coastal storm here on the weather,
right.
And he's freaking out that it's going to happen again.
Yeah. Look, so I understand that it's not so simple. And it sounds like he's more vulnerable than, let's
say,
the average kid because of, you know, his issues or whatever.
Right.
So it's to the extent that you can figure out a way to gently but firmly try to redirect his attention to other kind of stuff, especially now, because just think about it. I mean, you have first of all, there's a constant, it could be a constant trigger for him, any kind, and there's always bad weather somewhere.
I know.
A lot of kids don't have enough real-world information to know how to go with that. And with the stuff happening in Israel, that's another trigger for a lot of us, hopefully, because we feel like we're all in this together. So it's just something like, to the extent that you can, I understand it's not easy,
right.
But it's definitely a worthwhile boundary. It's definitely worthwhile. I'll tell you quick, after Armenia, so there's an Armenian earthquake, a lot of people are killed. So we did a study, with colleagues, where we looked at a bunch of people who were in the kids and adults in the earthquake city, kids who were relocated, and then a control group in the capital city. So we did a whole thing, and we found that actually, unlike the Scud attacks around the same time in Israel, the kids who stayed in the earthquake city, mm-hmm. even though usually that's therapeutic, because they didn't see rebuilding, which is, they did better if they were relocated, because they were surrounded by adults who weren't able to rebuild. As your children see you rebuild here, and you already see how quickly the rebuilding, that's why Israel is so quick to clean up the site of a terror attack. So we found what we found. But then we submit our findings to the Journal of American Academy of Child Psychiatry. They say, look, we want to publish your study. There's one weird thing. It found 25% post-traumatic stress disorder rate in the capital city, which was hundreds of kilometers away from where the earthquake was. How could these kids have PTSD? So the lead author, an Armenian psychiatrist who I became very friendly with, flies back to Armenia, and he re-interviews all the kids in the capital city and to ask, what was your PTSD to? We didn't know what it was. You know what it was to? They were all watching TV. And they all had relatives in the earthquake city. So it really, and then what we found after 9/11, just as like we expected, is one of the biggest risk factors for kids to have sustained issues was being glued to a TV set. So it's a hard thing to get control over, but it's important. One more thing, and this is just broadening it a little bit, is I want to share with you a sniper. It's more of a less of a study, more of a vignette. I have a friend at UCLA, the head of the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, a guy named Bob Pinus. So he was doing an early study in PTSD many years ago, and it was after a school sniper. There was a shooting on a playground in California where unfortunately a number of people were killed. It was one of the first school shootings. And there were 2 9-year-old boys who took cover under the same piece of playground equipment. They were exactly the same distance from the shooter. And one was a mess, and the other was totally fine. So Dr. Pinus interviewed the kid who was totally fine and said, why are you doing so well? You're really doing well. You know, I guess psychiatrists sometimes, you know, make things worse rather than better. And the kid says, oh, the shooting, I knew I'd be fine. He says, well, how did you know you'd be fine? He said, look. Said the week before the shooting, I was in an earthquake preparation course in a local community center. They tell me there's an earthquake, they tell me to run and take cover, they tell me exactly what to do. I hear the shooting, the kid says, and I knew exactly what to do. Now, he was no safer than anybody else. He was no safer than the kid next to him, but he believed that the adults in his community had given him a sense of control and a sense of efficacy that wasn't there otherwise. And that's what we have to remember with our kids, is that to the extent that we somehow give them a sense by talking to them about this and by giving them plans, or even with your son, giving them some kind of something, anything that'll take them from passive to active. It could be through chesed, it could be through acts of talking to them about safety during certain situations, or even telling them, you know, we don't want you to watch TV, it's a good way to protect you. You know, and I'll just end this before I keep quiet for a while. You know, with the beautiful Rav Hirsch, I heard this from Rav Matzio Solomon on the Wednesday after 9/11. We both spoke to a large group in Brooklyn. And he said, Kinesher Yar Kino Al Gozolav Yirachay. Right, so we're told that in a time of peril, we're compared to eagles. So Rav Hirsch says, why of all the animals in the world are Jews compared to eagles in a time of peril? He says, because any other animal, if their children are in peril, the children are in a passive position as the mother comes to protect them. Eagles, because they fly higher than any other living thing, when a baby eagle is in peril, the mother hovers over the nest. The baby eagle has to take an active role in its own salvation and jump on its back as the eagle flies to safety. And that's the metaphor for what we want. We want to give our kids, any way we can, that kind of an active role.
Yeah, I just I'll let you go. Israel has embarked on giving this kind of direction to the kids in schools, and many other countries have also, okay? It's a pre-event education, right? So you're not gonna wait till the disaster happens, you're gonna give them resiliency training, so to speak, without them knowing it, okay? We had an international conference on disaster preparedness past January, and there were tons of papers on this, and with good data. Showing that kids who have been spoken to and kind of pre-informed about that, not in a way to scare the hell out of them, but to empower them to do things. Like the kids in Sderot have drills of getting under tables and things like that. It gives you something to do, and they have to. Tzeva Adom, you have 15 seconds, and you're dead, okay, unless you get to cover.
But it empowers you to do something instead of go give up, like the, you know, you just lay there and wait, like, you know, which is just horrible. And there are ways to really do this. Something that's very interesting, and this is a plug which the rabbis will appreciate very much, looking at resiliency in Israel, if you look at very dati communities, okay, who've had terrible tragedies, shootings in their villages, you know, murders, etc., from terrorism, they do much better than other people, okay, in general. Okay, some people in Israel, psychiatrists who told us this, thought that was terrible. He said they're fanatics, they're crazy, you know, why is it okay, it's just ridiculous. I wanted to smack him, by the way, because he's talking to my group. And the answer is, if you believe that the Kadosh Baruch Hu does the right thing, if you believe that even though we're going through all kinds of tzoras, that ultimately we're going to be okay, it's helpful, okay? If you're oskei b'Torah, you know, it's a helpful thing, okay? So that's a plug for our religion and to have belief, ultimately the things are going to be okay. But what you said is very important, is kind of a pre-training kind of thing. And the media stuff, by the way, you know, a ton of people from 9/11 never experienced 9/11. They didn't have deaths in the family. They just watched TV. And this is clear that TV can make you have severe stress. Okay, and you know, we can't get rid of all my kids in Israel, Baruch Hashem, there's no TV, but they do have DVDs, I know. Okay, but you don't have the same exposure. There's also ways of, like, for instance, for your son, maybe, I hate to say this, I'll probably take it back, getting him a new Sony game or something, you know, that's exercise or something, will distract him from going to the internet all the time, and let him play games that will give him, you know, good stuff. There's very few of those to find, but that in your situation is extremely difficult. Find him something that's an alternate which he'll like better, and keep him away from it so much. You know, just as a practical matter.
Before you talk, yeah. I shared with some of you, I think I shared the shofar story in Sderot. Maybe I didn't. I don't remember what I said where, but it's just, this makes me feel so good. If you didn't, you might have been there. Did I share the shofar story with Chassidus Shaked?
I think I heard
about that. Yeah, yeah. It's just a nice story for today, you know. It's a friend of mine was doing some work with people in Sderot. She's a trauma person. And there was a Chassidus Shaked, a five-year-old kid living in a shchuna near Sderot, Chassidus shchuna near Sderot. And every time he heard Sev Adon, anytime he heard Code Red, he'd go nuts. He'd go into fight or flight, he'd run away, his mother would run after him. And it was really life-threatening. There were rockets flying all over the place. It was just not good. So she came up with this idea, which just, to me, is beautiful, because it shows how parents can shape their kids' perception in a way that totally shifts it, like that kid under sniper fire with earthquake preparation. She says to him, you know how Elul and Rosh Hashanah, when you hear the shofar, it's God's way of saying, get up, wake up, be alert. Come on, you have to act. But it's also God's way of saying, you're not alone, I'm with you. And somehow that connected to the kid. And from that point on, anytime he heard Zev Adom, he'd smile, he'd give his mother his hand, and together they'd walk down to the shelter calmly in plenty of time. Well, I guess not plenty of time, you have less than a minute, especially when you're so close.
Expanded a little bit, so just to ask a question regarding Israel. You have a number of families here that have kids here for the first time in Israel.
Yeah.
You also have people here who have family living in Israel. I'm taking off Monday to Israel. How do you address those parents who are nervous of how to deal with themselves as well as dealing with the kids in Israel?
Want to take that?
Well, I have two kids who live in Israel, and I have Baruch Hashem, my wife always yells, and I have 10 grandchildren. Okay. It ain't easy. Okay. When I heard, you know, Erev Shabbos, that a missile basically went over Ramat Beit Shemesh towards on its way to Yerushalayim. I was imagining in my head that the next one's going to hit their house. You know, it's just human nature. It's terrifying. The way I deal with it is, I live in New York. We all live in New York. Okay, I do disaster preparedness here. I talk about certain things that have happened here. You know, the Kadosh Baruch Hu does what he does. Beslan is in Russia. Beslan is a city that's in the middle of nowhere. And one of my guys who does these disasters in Israel, who's a colonel in the IDF, spoke at a village right next to Beslan about disaster preparedness. And on day two, they said to him, why did you come here? Like, why? Nothing ever, this is like the middle of Russia. Like, you're out of, like, why are you wasting your time with this Narishkeit, okay? And a few weeks later, 100 some odd kids were killed by Chechen terrorists, okay? So you can sit in a cocoon and worry about everything, okay? But you know, if you live in New York, if you live in Oklahoma City, oh my God, why would anyone touch Oklahoma City? Except Timothy McVeigh, Machimo, who walked through the nursery school the day before. He knew there were 30 kids at a nursery school there. He called them collateral damage, okay? You don't know what's going to be right, what's going to be wrong, where they should be, where they shouldn't be. You know, I had kids living in Israel during the Intifada. One of them had a bullet go past his head, okay, one day, sitting somewhere. Baruch Hashem is okay. Then I had a plane drop on Bell Harbor, okay, right after 9/11. And they're calling me from Israel, getting bombed, and I'm having planes drop on me. So the point is, you know, you never know where it's going to be or what's going to happen. To some degree. I'm not saying you should put yourself necessarily in a dangerous situation. You know, there are all kinds of halachos about that, and it's not so simple. But for me, I try to put the spin on that you're being mekayem a mitzvah to be in Eretz Yisrael. You're giving chizuk to Eretz Yisrael, okay? You're proud of your kids because of what they're doing, right? And there is the mitzvah factor and the God factor in all this, beside the own hishtadlus factor, okay? And we should be proud of them, and we should be have the bitachon to some degree that at the end of the day the Kaddish Baruch is the right thing, if not maybe for our guf right now, but for our neshamas, okay? And that helps me. And when I'm in Israel and I go to Sderot, I've had kassams miss me twice already, okay? And been experienced sevadom. I brought home shrapnel pieces to show people, okay? I can't explain why it didn't really bother me so much, because I felt like I'm here, I'm kind of doing the right thing, okay? And Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh, and it just helps. For me, I'm just getting individual thought process about this. You know, for your kids, you know, I'll tell you a good way to deal with it is to say to yourself, I'm going to Eretz Yisrael, unless you're pulling your kids back or something, I have to be strong for them, okay? I got to put on the good face, okay? And I've got to show them that, you know, we're good, okay? And I'm giving you chizuk. I'm here for you. If you want to come home, it's also okay. You have to assess the kids, okay? I had kids in school all during the Intifada, okay, having all kinds of, you know, crazy thoughts. And at one point, I'll tell you, my wife and I did bring two of our kids home for sukkahs, okay? There's just too much already. There's bombings every day and buses blowing up and everything else. But 10 days later, we sent them back. Okay, because we just said, no, it was the wrong decision. Okay, everyone's got to make their individual decision. I can't tell each person how to deal with it. Okay, but on a daily basis in Sderot, in other places, there is stuff going on. It's just a lot of people don't know about it. Okay, and I just believe it's got a kesher to believe in God and beyond the normal stuff. Okay, because otherwise you say just pull them out. Bring it back to New York. You bring it back to New York, and the Pathfinder will blow up in Times Square. I mean, you just don't know anymore.
I don't know if you remember. There was somebody who was supposed to go to Israel during the Maccabee competitions, and he was just worried because of what was going on in Israel then. So he stayed home, and you know, stayed with his job at one of the top floors in the World Trade Center on 9/11. You never know. I mean, it was like, you know.
And by the way, that's not the answer.
It's not the answer, but it's true.
And I don't want people to feel like, yeah, Frogo's a little crazy. Don't you know, you know? There really is something bad going on here, and you know, you shouldn't put yourself in danger. But on the other hand, I'm just trying to say, and the people in Israel, by the way, the majority of the people, even during the Intifada, when you could get on a bus in Yerushalayim and get blown up, okay, they made believe, at least on the surface, for their kids and for everyone else, we're good to go. I had people become hysterical with me who were tough Israeli army people saying every day I sent my kid on that bus, it killed me. I wanted to be with them. I just wanted to hold my kid all the time and be with them because I could. How do I let them go? But they said to themselves, we have to live. The terrorists win. They win That's what they want. That's what terror is about. Terror is to make the population so scared that they don't function, they have PTSD. And I know the guy who set in place the, after Sabara was blown up, to clean up the sites right away, okay, he was in charge of the Home Front Command, okay, he speaks all over the world, and that was a major thing, because what it says is, it's in your face. We're cleaning up, we're back to where we are, we're chazak, you're weak, you're a lunatic, you're destroying your families, you're blowing yourselves up, we're not giving into this lunacy. We're going to live our lives, and we're going to be resilient, and we're going to take it on, okay? And that's important. And you know what? Some of us may die, and you know, soldiers die all the time. They get their legs blown up. I mean, you see the most horrible stuff. You go to the hospitals, you go to the rehab centers. But you know what? At the end of the day, they're kedoshim and tahorim, okay? And we say kel moles and stuff like that. You know, that's what it's about. And you know what? Those neshamas go upstairs and get to the good places, okay? At the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm planning a trip with my family soon to Israel. Is there any good way to prepare my kids that are 3, 4, and 6 years old to what hopefully by the time we get there the situation will be over? But is there any way to prepare them on?
So let's talk about that age range. 3, 4, and 6 is and for those of you who have kids who are preschoolers. It's an age where kids are very likely to misunderstand anyway. I remember a few days after 9/11, there was a set of 4-year-old twins in my office whose fathers were killed in the Twin Towers. And one of the kids looks up at her mother and says, "Mommy, why does everybody hate twins so much?" Because it was an attack to them. It was an attack on them as twins, having their father taken from them, and an attack on the Twin Towers. Because kids that age are concrete. They're concrete. They're likely to misunderstand. They're likely to have a very different sense of time. And probably, you in terms of preparing them now, if you're, what are you going and how long?
6 weeks.
6 weeks. So child time at that age, 6 weeks is way too, I wouldn't be talking about it at all now. What I would, when you get there, is, or maybe a little before you get there, but probably when you get there, it totally depends what's going on.
Right.
But my guess is to stay concrete. At that point, you just need to keep them nearby. You know, you figure out what are the, where are the shelters in that area. God forbid things are still going on then. I sincerely hope they aren't. And you almost have to deal with it as it comes. If, God forbid, something happens that they're exposed to, which is very unlikely. And at that point, you do have to be aware. I was... part of the DSM-IV post-traumatic stress disorder field trials, which was like when they were developing the PTSD diagnosis. One of the main questions we asked ourselves in the different parts of the country we were doing the research was, what's the worst age in life to be traumatized? And surprisingly, it turned out to be preschool. It's a tough age to be traumatized because of everything I'm saying, because you get it wrong. But we now know that if, God forbid, something happens to kids that age, if you talk to them and just watch their play and give them, surround them with a protective shield and allow them to be clingy in the short term, maybe sleep in your bed for a few days before you gently push them back into their bed. And I'm talking now here more about your kids in this neighborhood who may be that age. Those are some of the guidelines. And you want to get into their head a little bit to see what they think about all of this, because that's where the risk comes from. Many of them are totally fine afterwards, but those who aren't, or if you're seeing any kind of regressed or weird different behavior now, you know, more than 2 weeks after the storm, you should be thinking about, what's happening, and hopefully, it's what you just asked is a very theoretical question.
Let me just. A lot of damage can be done by talking about something that's theoretical to little kids, okay? Before it could even happen, as you said. But I just really want to reemphasize that. You can't have a long discussion, like with an adult or a teenager, for a half hour with your 3-year-old. You have no clue what he's hearing, okay? He's distracted, he's here. He's reflecting that, and if you seem upset when you're telling him, he's reflecting your upsetness, okay? And you may not sense it, but you're having a serious talk with your 3-year-old, usually playing, running, going, jumping. It's going to start to freak him out, Okay? I'm serious. Before anything happens, don't do it. Don't go there. Okay?
What I was considering doing was maybe having some kind of game where we pretend like there's a siren and go run into the basement or something. Just like when it happens in real life, we're like, oh, we're playing the game again.
Yeah, but I'll suspect that you playing that game are going to be like, not normal. Okay? Your kid's going to go. Don't think so. The kids reflect what the mother, the primary caretaker, is feeling. So if the mother, primary caretaker, is depressed and upset and crying all the time and has PTSD, there's a higher chance of the kids having it. And it's obvious, yeah. Right?
Younger the kid. So the younger the kid, the higher the correlation between parental response and child response. But something you might find helpful, if when you're there, it looks like there's a high likelihood of continued attacks, is there's a very nice little YouTube video called, I think you do a search, Code Red Stay Wrote. I could probably send an email with it. It's a beautiful example of how a preschool teacher, actually it's a preschool art therapist, music therapist, teaches the kids in the preschools in Stay Wrote through a song, mm-hmm. how to get ready for responding to the siren. And then you see what happens is the kids do the game that you're talking about, but with this song, and it says, you know, my heart is beating fast, and that's good. And then it ends with their saying, and I know exactly what to do, and then they all scream out, yes, you know, I'm the, you know. And it's a beautiful, because what you see is the kids going from being panicked to going to a very calm place, because the adults are shaping the experience for them with the music. If you send me an email, I should be able, if it's not too graphic, so I send you the link, or else I could send you, I actually have the file, otherwise I could send you a link I could create a link that I'd be able to share it with you. So it's deepcomfortments at Gmail. But do it, only don't do it unless, God forbid, things are still happening in 6 weeks. Hmm. Okay?
That is your question. We have an issue of security patrol, CSS, the last year or so. What are your views about that? Because as someone who was out there, and my kid said, what are you, crazy? And there comes a mixture of views. I guess if you took down the aisle voters, whether to keep it or not, most people say, you're crazy, we don't need it here. So what are your views about the importance of something? And then the kids, when kids see people on patrol, and what's your viewpoint on that?
I have mixed feelings about it. But you know what? If God forbid something happens and we didn't have it, you know, everyone would say, like, why didn't we have it? You know, the vast majority of shuls and synagogues in the United States are not doing it at this point in time. But again, having eyes and ears open is a good thing. Maybe it could be done in a way that's not as visible, perhaps. Although that it does maybe serve as a deterrent, but I'm not so sure that the kind of terror we're dealing with. So you might want to think about that, have it less of a standing on the corner, obviously, and make it more of a hidden kind of thing. You know, we have your eyes and ears open, but you're not out there. Because I'm not sure that, I'm not a security person. I'm not sure that deterrence is so great if terrorists or somebody want to, you know, it's different if somebody's going to loot a store. You know, if you have a security guard there, they may not come to your store, so to speak. The effect on the kids, I wouldn't get into big discussions with the kids about it. I would just say the synagogue board has decided this is what we're going to do, and it's a good thing. We have eyes and ears, and yeah, it's an okay thing. I wouldn't get into a whole, you know, we have to protect the shul. There could be terrorists. There could be this. There could be that. Because that's very counterproductive, especially the older kids. You know, with teenagers, they're really pressing you. They may be scared that you guys have a threat, a specific threat on the young Israel, okay? And you need to tell them, no, we don't. We don't have a specific threat. We just, you know, we had a little OCD. We take our medication and we're doing security.
Heard about us, huh?
Just kidding.
Okay.
Any questions or thoughts from back here?
Yes.
Yeah,
she's nervous about going to Israel.
Ah, okay. How can you not be?
That's sweet.
And you know, and that's really what it's about. It's about how do you manage anxiety about the unknown? And you know, it's the most normal thing in the world. You know, we all know that when you get there, we all have the experience. It just doesn't feel nearly as scary. It's from afar that it's scary.
Yeah, and I talked to my kids, I'm speaking, they were all upset with having here, and now that it's there, they're going, oh, it's, although my daughter was telling me before Shabbos, don't worry, they're not going near Jerusalem.
Hmm.
And then
she said,
oh, we're in lockdown. We can't go. We're going to
be in lockdown. Yeah, what school is she in?
She's in Ramat Eshkol.
Yeah.
And she's, they can't go into town. They can't do anything. And they said that they have the bomb shelter in the bottom.
They wanted near the bomb shelter.
So. And she said a lot of kids went to all over Israel. They heard sirens. Where she was in Petah Tikva. She didn't hear any sirens, but all her other friends heard sirens and they had her run into shelters.
I think most schools are locked down now, especially the girls' schools.
But you know what? But I was also, this is supposed to be such a carefree time for everyone in Israel.
I must say, every person is different. Some people who are going to Israel just for a trip and are totally freaked out about it, you might not want it. You might want to defer it. It's okay. You know, there's nothing bad about doing that, by the way. It's okay. All right. On the other hand, if you feel it's okay and you want to go, it's also okay. I like to give people options sometimes because I'm not inside your head. I can't necessarily understand, you know, how you're feeling, how much anxiety you have. In general, though, I think what I said before stands, you know, for me. I think for the kids who are in Israel, you know, the basket, I know lots and lots and lots of kids, they're strengthened by it to some degree, and it makes them grow up to a large degree, and it's not necessarily a bad thing, okay? And yes, life's about fun, but it's also about reality sometimes. And this for Am Yisrael, it's an Am Yisrael reality, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. Now, you may think totally differently, but that's
not. Since different people have different coping mechanisms, and for some of those people, going to sleep at on time is one of those mechanisms, I'm going to allow those who want to take that advantage of that opportunity to do so. And I want to thank Dr. Palkovitz and Dr. Frogel for.
Thank you.
Could I just make an offer? I'm leaving Monday night, as I said.